Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Thursday, January 8th. I'm Ray Graff. It's time to talk astronomy on the program. And we welcome back Dr. Valerie Rapson to talk astronomy with you, possibly Bob Berman, although we haven't seen him yet. So it might be a solo shot for Valerie Rapson today. Give us a call, 800-348-2551. If you have an astronomy question, 800-348-2551. Or you can email us at voxpop@wamc.org, voxpop@wamc.org, or 800-348-2551, astronomy, and your calls coming up. Hello again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. It's astronomy today, and we welcome back Dr. Valerie Rapson to answer your calls. Dr. Rapson is an assistant professor of physics and astronomy at SUNY Oneonta. She earned her Ph.D. in astrophysical science and technology at RIT. If you have a question, give us a call. 800-348-2551 is our number. 1-800-348-2551. You may also email the program. Happy to read those as they come in. voxpop@wamc.org. voxpop@wamc.org is the email. The number is 800-348-2551. Dr. Valerie Rapson, how are you? Welcome back. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. I'm doing great. It's still break for me, so this is really nice.
Did you go out and look at the stars on New Year's Eve?
Not really. It wasn't too clear at my house.
Actually, I think we had a nice storm.
It's just generally been cloudy the last couple of weeks. I had hopes of, you know, using the new telescope and just, you know, trying all this stuff, and it's been constant clouds.
Now, when, you know, you're a professor at SUNY Oneonta, what does your calendar look like? When do you start prepping for the beginning of the new semester?
Well, I usually start over break because I'm someone who likes to have at least most of the lessons laid out and the syllabus done, because it just makes me feel comfortable and then I can adjust more easily. So I've been working on it a little bit over break, but in a very relaxed setting, you know, with the cats on my lap in front of the computer at home kind of thing.
That is great. That's a fun way to work. Mm-hmm. The number here is 800-348-2551. Email is voxpop@wamc.org. All right, we bandied about a few topics to start the show.
Yeah.
And one that you sent me, of course, if you were hoping that 3i Atlas was an alien spacecraft, unfortunately, that is not the case. Mm-hmm. Valerie, you sent an article from, I believe it is, from? I'll figure it out. It's space.com.
Okay.
And it says, interstellar comet 3i Atlas isn't an alien spacecraft. Astronomers confirm, in the end, there were no surprises.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Wow. We've been looking at this for a while. You know, there's the speculation that it was, you know, someone sent an alien spacecraft this way, but it looks like a comet. All of the data we've seen, we see the tails now. Everything makes sense. There are some peculiarities, you know, some weird, like there's too much carbon dioxide and nickel. So there's weird things about it, but that doesn't mean that it's an interstellar spacecraft. It just means that it's a really interesting cometary object that didn't form in our solar system.
All right, so this came from outside of our solar system. Mm-hmm. What does the abundance of carbon dioxide and nickel, what can you infer from that?
Right. Well, they're kind of separate things. Usually we compare carbon dioxide to water because it's basically like dry ice and frozen water. And as the comet comes in, you will see it sublimate and you'll see generally more water than carbon dioxide because it's easier for the water to sublimate off the surface. But when we looked at it initially, we saw more carbon dioxide, which was strange. There's only one other comet we've seen with a ratio of it this high. And we don't know. It could just be that there's more carbon dioxide naturally. Maybe the comet didn't warm up as much as other comets do. So it just looks kind of strange. And then the nickel and iron thing, most comets, they have ice on the surface and heavier metals in the middle. This one seems to have lots of nickel and essentially no iron. And that's more unexplained than the carbon dioxide thing, because never have we seen an object that only shows signatures of nickel instead of iron mixed together. And we don't know where that comes from.
Well, maybe it would be instructive if you told us in terms that we can understand about the formation of comets. How do they form? Where do they form? And why do they form?
Yeah, well, they form just like any other planetary object. You imagine you've got a cloud of gas and dust around a star. Most of the material collapses down into the larger planetary objects. But at the edge of the solar system, far from the sun, you can have smaller objects form under smaller influences of gravity. But there's still heavy metals, ices, the same kind of things we find in planets way out at the edge. So they do the same thing as the Earth. If they are differentiated, which just means that the heavier stuff falls towards the middle, you'll see that nickel, iron, rocky core, and then ice on the outside. It's just the mixture of materials is unique, and we're not sure if this comet has a unique mixture, or maybe the iron or other materials is like locked up in molecules and we just weren't able to see it in the spectrum.
This is so interesting. Now, in our own solar system, and maybe I have this wrong, but there's this thing, the Oort cloud, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that's where most of our comets are lurking, and that's where they originate?
Yes, lots of them are really far out in the Oort cloud. Some do come from the Kuiper belt where Pluto is, but most of them we think come from the Oort cloud.
There are these heavy metals, right? And the heavy metals, and I don't know anything, but they come from stars or that go supernova, right?
Right, right, exactly.
And how do these sort of small amounts of iron or nickel or whatever just sort of hang out freeform way out in the
right.
solar system?
Well, they're just feeling the influence of the sun's gravity like everything else. You know, originally there was a giant cloud with essentially equal mixtures of metals throughout, and the metal on the outside is going to condense down with the ices and create these comets.
So the Oort cloud is before the heliopause. It's nearer to us than the heliopause.
No, it is further out.
It is
the Kuiper belt is closer to us, but the Oort cloud is farther away.
And yet there's still gravitational influence of the sun.
Sure, sure. It's small, and we're getting like almost to the point where it's actually influenced by other nearby stars, but the Oort cloud is still bound to the sun. It's just the further away you go, the less gravity you feel, but the gravity is always still there.
And because 3I Atlas came from another solar system, do we know about the direction it came from?
No, I mean,
no idea what galaxy.
We have a general idea.
It's our galaxy.
It's our galaxy for sure. We have a general idea. It entered basically in the same plane as the solar system. So if you just kind of project outward, we could, you know, go out to another star. But we don't know how long it's been traveling. So it might have come from a nearby star. It might have come from somewhere else. You have to think about how the star positions have changed over the time it's been traveling. So we
don't
really know.
There's software for that, right?
There is, but it can't. It's not super accurate, right? And we can only make assumptions based on the motions of the stars we see right now. It's hard to include all the influences of the other stars on each other, right? I can take each star and model how it's going to orbit around the galaxy right now, but how is it being influenced by everything else nearby? That's not always included properly. It's hard.
It's incredible. Mm-hmm. So Valerie Rapson is our guest today. It's astronomy. 800-348-2551 is our number. VoxPop@WAMC.org. You sent me another one here, and this is from NASA.gov. NASA Hubble helps detect wake of Betelgeuse's elusive companion star.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I've not heard of this. Explain.
I didn't know either that we were even thinking about this. So everybody, I think, knows Betelgeuse, right? The bright star in Orion.
Yep.
And I knew that scientists had been watching it because it does this weird pulsation in brightness and also in like chemical composition. When you look at the spectra, it seems to change over like a 6-year time frame. And astronomers weren't sure if it was like the star doing something weird or if there was potentially a companion, like a smaller star orbiting around and affecting Betelgeuse in some way. Well, that seems to be the case. The images we've got of Hubble are not of the object in particular, but we're seeing like gas motions as if there is an object moving in front of Betelgeuse in this predictable 6-year pattern. Excuse me. And we can pretty much for sure say now that there's a small star literally inside the atmosphere of Betelgeuse that's orbiting around it as we speak.
I find that's an interesting turn of phrase. And most of us don't think of that. Betelgeuse, it's a star.
Mm-hmm.
It has an atmosphere.
Right.
Do all stars have atmospheres?
They do, but Betelgeuse is a supergiant. So it has expanded. Like if Betelgeuse was our sun, it has expanded out to the orbit of Jupiter. It's huge. And its atmosphere is essentially just the upper layers of the star. And it's hard to define where the quote-unquote star begins and the atmosphere ends, you know, because there's not really a surface to look at when the star grows that big. So we don't know yet exactly where the star is, like how far from the star's center the second star is, but it's definitely inside of the atmosphere or the outer plasma, I guess, of Betelgeuse.
Amazing. And we've never seen this little companion star before.
No, we haven't seen it. And the paper wasn't published yet, so they didn't have all the images, but I don't think we've officially seen it per se. We're just seeing like the motions of the gases that show that something is moving around and it's dense enough to be an actual star, not just like a gas cloud or something.
Could it be an enormous planet?
Well, I guess it could be, but I think the size, based on how big it has to be to create these effects, would likely make it a small star.
Okay, and the Hubble is visual?
Mm-hmm.
Is that
yes,
a visual
primarily,
telescope?
Yes, it does a little infrared and UV, but not very much.
What could some of the other telescopes up there tell us about this?
Well, I think it'll be interesting. You know, obviously we'll point James Webb at it because we point James Webb at pretty much everything.
Yeah.
So we'll hopefully, you know, maybe be able to detect something directly there. Betelgeuse is actually close enough for us to see a visual surface of the star. Like we can actually see hot spots and stuff because it's so big. I don't know if James Webb would be able to give us maybe some more resolution. It might be a little too bright actually to see it really well, but we might be able to at least see a hot spot or some sort of feature that tells us when the star is actually crossing in front. And I think the article said in like 2028, we expect it to be in front of the star again. So that'll be our time to actually look at it.
So this is great science. This is a prediction and you'll
mm-hmm.
see if this actually
right.
happens.
Right, exactly.
All right, final one here, and then we'll take a break, and then we'll hit the phones or the emails. Dr. Valerie Rapson is our guest. The number is 800-348-2551. It's Astronomy Today. You can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. I sent this one to you before the New Year's celebration. This was December 29th in the New York Post. Our universe is heading for gravitational collapse, known as the Big Crunch, as dark matter is rapidly changing. That's according to a study.
Mm-hmm.
True, not true, sensationalism?
Well,
what do we got here?
You know, I don't know that it's sensationalism. I mean, it was a real peer-reviewed study, which is really cool. Basically, what these scientists did is they've been looking at galaxies and how they're all, you know, moving away from us. That hasn't changed. But they're trying to figure out how fast the galaxies are moving away. And they use the standard, you know, variable star supernova to figure out distances, to help us with speeds. Excuse me. And we figured out that what seems to appear to be happening is if you correlate the supernova brightness with the age of the galaxy, that changes our prediction as to how fast the universe was moving at different times. And we might not be continually expanding faster and faster like we thought.
Oh.
We're still expanding, but that rate at which we're expanding is slowing down. So eventually it could stop. And maybe even reverse and give us like the big crunch that they talk about where the universe comes flying back in at us.
Now, the headline is wrong, isn't it? Because they're talking about dark energy, aren't they, in the study? And the headline says dark matter is rapidly changing. It's dark energy that they're talking about.
I believe
isn't it?
So. Yeah, I'd have to double check and see. But yes, it's dark energy that is pushing the universe out. So they may have misspoke there.
Amazing. The New York Post got a headline wrong. That's impossible.
You know, it's tricky. You know, dark matter and dark energy, they get confused all the time.
I mean, what is it? Do we still know? Is it possible that all of this that we've seen here, this alleged slowing down of the expansion of mm-hmm. the universe based upon a rapidly changing dark energy
mm-hmm.
is just not us understanding what dark energy is, even if it's a real thing.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's definitely some scientists who are working on that side of the theory. Like maybe we just need to update our math. You know, no different than when Einstein discovered relativity, it kind of fixed our math and
yeah.
explained a lot of things. This would not be, you know, negating dark energy by any means. It would just be adjusting its strength over time, essentially. And instead of dark energy being a constant force, it may have changed. It may have increased or decreased at certain times for who knows what reason, because we don't know what it actually is or how it works.
Yeah. Well, that's a problem, isn't
but,
it?
Yeah. But, you know, how we describe it may change, and that may ultimately enlighten us into what it is. If it has some weird predictable pattern, maybe we can match that up to other things that we can observe and actually figure out what the heck it is.
Now, you know, in fairness, if the dark crunch does happen, we have, what, a trillion years? We have a long time.
Yeah, yeah.
We'll
yeah.
be fine.
Oh, yeah. No, you shouldn't stress about this at all.
Fair enough. All right, let's take a break. I feel much better. 800-348-2551 is our number. 1-800-348-2551. Dr. Valerie Rapson is here. It's astronomy. Email us at voxpop@wamc.org. We'll check the email bag in a moment. There's Brown Bag by Boogaloo Joe Jones here on Vox Pop. You know, just a moment here to remind you that the lockbox is open. News never stops. We never stop at WAMC. But one thing that has stopped is federal funding. And that impacts everything we do here at WAMC. Every day, we try to bring you complete stories, thoughtful context, even some new ideas. And now, we're relying entirely on individual support to continue that service. Your lockbox gift right now helps us protect the news you depend on, reduces the on-air fundraising, and I know you like that idea. Give us your money right now, just a little bit. Doesn't have to be a lot. Any amount is great. WAMC.org. Feed that lockbox. We'll shorten the fund drive, and trust me, I'll mention it again. You'll hear it about it again. It's Vox Pop on WAMC, 800-348-2551. Ray Graff here. We're with Valerie Rapson. Dr. Rapson is a professor of physics and astronomy at SUNY Oneonta, on break and looking very relaxed. It's quite amazing. Ben in Providence wrote in much earlier today.
Sure.
Around 6 o'clock on the 27th of December, I saw an object streaking through the sky from about 80 degrees overhead to about 50 degrees north-northwest. Mm-hmm. It was a bright streak, then it burst into a green flash. This was in Rhode Island. Is it possible that this was a meteor or space junk? And that is from Ben in Providence.
Yeah, it definitely sounds like a meteor that they saw through the sky, especially being quick, that bluish-green color that the flash was. That sounds exactly like a meteor in the sky.
Really?
Yeah, it's really cool. And they're like, you can never predict them, right? And you always seem to catch them out of the corner of your eye. You're never quite staring in the right spot. So if he was looking right at it, that's pretty amazing.
One day in maybe late 70s, early 80s, I was driving along 787, driving south. Mm-hmm. So toward the end of 787, right along the parallel to the Hudson River, daytime. Mm-hmm. Brilliant green flash in the sky. In the day,
yeah,
it was a meteor.
That's cool.
Yeah, I mean, to be bright enough to be seen in daylight, that's something.
Yeah, that's so rare.
All right, Nicole writes in, my 14-year-old daughter loves science. She participates in Science Olympiad through her school, but we are looking for a science program this summer. Any suggestions?
My suggestion is to look at a bunch of the different universities as they sometimes offer programs for high school students.
Do you guys do that at Oneonta?
We don't at Oneonta, and I'm not sure, you know, Capital Region area if there was, but I grew up in the Rochester area, and I'm pretty sure the University of Rochester still does them because I used to teach them when I was younger. But there's, you know, a lot of the bigger, usually private universities will offer these types of programs, and I both took one and taught one about astronomy, one about like particle physics. It's really neat because the professors often help, or students, like graduate students, will teach them, and your high schooler can learn a ton.
Now, I mean, you don't have to tell me that you're brilliant, but how old were you when you were interested in particle physics?
I was fascinated by particle physics probably by like 13 years old.
Oh, my heavens.
I have this like, well, I don't have it anymore, but I remember this poster board I made of CERN, you know, the particle collider.
Yeah.
And because you can sketch the fun drawings of how the particles collide and what they turn into. Maybe I liked the artistic side more than the particle physics side at that point, but it was really cool.
You know, hearing something like that makes me, the broadcaster, feel like the ultimate underachiever. What have I done with my life? James in Greenwich, you're on with Dr. Valerie Rapson.
Yes. Hi, how are you today?
Good. Welcome.
Good. I have a quick question. I was thinking about dark matter and how we don't know where it's coming from. Mm-hmm. And my idea was that maybe it's time displacement or time dilation, where the matter itself, almost like a Doppler effect, how sound has a Doppler effect. As we move in time, in our present time, we have this gravitational pull of the matter, but let's say the further away we get from the past and the further into the future, the matter, gravitational energy or whatever kind of like dissipates. Mm-hmm. And it's almost like a Doppler effect.
Yeah, well, I think if you're thinking more in terms of like the dark energy and the energy that's pushing the galaxies away and stuff, those types of ideas, they have been incorporated into the theories of dark energy, because you're describing relativity, which is all true things. And we include that when we come up with these models of dark energy, and there still seems to be something missing. It's not just that we are, you know, forgetting to account for these time dilations or not stretching the universe properly in our minds. We've included that, and there still seems to be this apparent extra push that we've never seen before.
James.
Oh, excellent. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
Thanks a lot. Now, there was a, and I believe me, I get confused between dark matter and dark energy myself, but there was a time not too many years ago when it was discussed that maybe neither of these things exist, mm-hmm. and that gravity, and I think some Israeli scientists were looking into this, mm-hmm. that gravity might act differently. You know how it acts mm-hmm. differently in the very tiny?
Yes. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That maybe very far away,
yeah.
it also acts differently.
Right. We still haven't solved the whole gravity matching quantum mechanics, you know, bridging the scales and everything. That is still unsolved. And if we figure it out, that could solve all our problems and explain everything. It's just we have too many observables where even the smartest minds in the world can't seem to figure out math that fixes and matches what we observe. So that's why we're kind of hanging on to this idea that, you know, dark matter exists and dark energy has to be there, because we just can't come up with any fathomable math that makes sense.
So is it just a crutch? Is it a placeholder? But you know what? We can't figure this out. So let's make up something called dark energy.
In the simplest sense, yeah, that's exactly what it is. We call it dark because we can't see it. We can't explain it. And then just the matter and energy terms come in based on how we observe it acting on things. But honestly, yeah, I mean, that's what it is. It's a name we give to something that we can't explain so we can talk about it.
You know, I had Dr. Kevin Knuth on yesterday. We were talking about scientific UAP and UFO research yesterday.
Yeah.
And he's a brilliant guy, too.
Oh,
and
yeah.
I did ask him, I said, you know, does it kind of bug you as you get older that you'll never figure everything out? Does it bug you, Valerie, that you'll, all these mysteries, you'll never get to the end of all of them?
Well, yes and no. I mean, I'm sad that I will never know all the answers, but I'm excited because that's the motivation, right? Like, that's why the scientists keep doing what they're doing, is that these big mysteries, dark matter, dark energy, life in the universe, like, we want those answers. And that's what keeps me going to work every day and teaching more students and learning more myself, because I want to know as much as I can before I die, basically. I want this all figured out.
All right. Well, when you figure it out, will you let me know before I die?
I will. I'll give you the hint. You know, if I find out there's aliens first, I'll let you know.
We'll do a special show. Dr. Valerie Rapson is our guest today. It's astronomy. We did the UFO show yesterday, so it's astronomy today, folks. 800-348-2551 is the number. VoxPop@WAMC.org. Now, someone who wants to talk about the Oort cloud is Merle in Argyle. So let's go to Merle in Argyle. Hello, Merle. How are you?
Well, I just got out of the hospital.
Oh, no. What happened, man? You okay? Okay, I won't ask. All right, fine. You're all right now?
No.
Oh, splendid. No, boy.
But the first thing I did was turn you guys on.
Well, thank you.
When I got home.
Got it, man.
All right. I'm doing better.
Good.
All right, this has to do with the Oort cloud, and I've asked the question before, and it still doesn't comprehend in my small mind.
Your Oort cloud question.
You say that the Atlas Oort comet is coming in at an angle that says it doesn't come from the Oort cloud.
Yes.
I think of the Oort cloud as a big round bubble around our solar system. Mm-hmm. Is that correct?
Yes, yes, that is correct.
Okay, this
and
is good.
It's got a bunch of comets in it. Now you think of a billiard ball and a rack of a bunch of balls, and you throw one and it hits another and hits another and hits another, and some places it gets more energy and some places it gets less.
Mm-hmm.
So you can come in at the sun at any angle from the Oort cloud.
All right.
Is that correct?
All right, so let's see. Is that true?
Yeah. So Merle, you're exactly right in your description. I see where you're going, as you're saying, you know, things can bump into each other and maybe 3I Atlas came in at that angle just by chance. The piece that we're missing is that it's coming in too fast. So yes, things can come in from the Oort cloud in the plane of the solar system. That's not particularly rare. What's strange is that this one is coming in much too fast.
Speed from Jupiter, right?
Say it again, Merle.
You could pick up speed from Jupiter.
So slingshotting around Jupiter. But we saw it before then, didn't we?
Well, we saw it for the first time when it was passing Jupiter, and we can project it forwards and backwards. And even with Jupiter's gravity, it was still moving way too fast to be bound by the sun. So, you know, yes, you can have a little push. It's going so fast. I think it was like 41 kilometers a second or something, like way too fast for the sun to have ever held on to this comet. So it could not have come from the
outside. All right, Merle. Hey, you know what? Great question.
Okay.
And I hope you feel better, buddy. Thanks for calling. 800-348-2551 is our number. Dr. Valerie Rapson is here. That's really cool. Now, you know, I think we have trouble conceptualizing how far things are apart.
Yeah.
If this Oort cloud is all the way around the solar system,
mm-hmm.
that doesn't mean that they're close together, these comets,
right?
They're just, they're very far apart.
Right, exactly. And we've never actually seen the Oort cloud, so we have no true idea of the density or the closeness of any of these objects. We are just speculating based on how much time it takes these long period comets to go around the sun. Like, they come in and they go out a certain distance, and that distance is always very similar. So we're saying, okay, the Oort cloud must be a thing that exists because they all go out to approximately the same distance. But we have no idea if there's tens or hundreds or millions of comets out there. We don't really know.
Why can't we take a look? We have all these telescopes that are space-based now.
Right.
They can see very far.
Well, comets are really small, and at the distance of the Oort cloud, they would be really cold. So even if, you know, James Webb, our biggest, best telescope right now, looked out there, it wouldn't be able to just catch something so small and so faint.
Voyager has gone through it already?
Voyager has not gone through it. Voyager is headed out in that direction, but, you know, Voyager's only at maybe, I don't know, maybe almost 100 AU. I don't remember exactly where
it is. So it's beyond the heliopause, right?
It's beyond the heliopause, but the Oort cloud is usually at like thousands of astronomical units or tens of thousands. So it's much further out.
And it's bound by gravity to our sun.
Mm-hmm.
This blows my mind. If this thing exists, the Oort cloud,
sure.
It's so far out there.
Right.
And yet every now and then the orbits of these big comets come zinging right through.
Mm-hmm.
What can we learn about gravity from that? I mean, these things are small.
Mm-hmm.
One, where did they come from to be broken up like this? And two, how do they stay there without floating off into space?
Right. Well, they must be in like really nice, relatively circular orbits, the ones that aren't flying in towards the sun, to stay that way. And they're all moving slow enough so that they aren't leaving the gravity of the sun. If you're going to be that far out and still bound to the sun, you got to move really slowly, because a little bit of a push is going to push you out of the solar system or maybe push you in towards the sun if that's the direction you get nudged. And that's what we see with the comets. But they're just peacefully bound to the sun, moving at just the right speed to stay there. And that's why they exist.
So when the average comet from our solar system comes mm-hmm. around and comes near, how fast is it going?
Well, it depends. It depends on where it came from and at what distance it's going. But we're talking, you know, maybe a few kilometers a second or so. Ballpark.
So 3i Atlas was way faster.
Yeah, 3i Atlas was flying really fast.
Interesting. Let's go to the phones once again. Dr. Valerie Rapson is our guest. It's Astronomy, 800-348-2551. Michael is in Clifton Park. Hello, Michael.
Hi, Roy Graff, or Ray Graff, sorry.
Howdy.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
You got it.
My question is for Dr. Valerie Rapson there. I'm a little nervous getting online with you guys.
Don't worry, man.
I'm sorry.
It's all good.
Yeah, I'm talking too fast. My question was for Dr. Rapson there. I've heard a lot on the internet, on these different YouTube and whatever on the internet, about experiments being done on the International Space Station where oil and water don't mix the same way they do here on Earth.
Huh.
And I was just wondering, hoping that the doctor could fill myself and everybody else, all the listeners in on how things react differently when they're up there. The other key word in my question was maybe in terms of tens of thousands of feet, because I've heard about the, you know, I don't need to use all my key words here, but I've heard about the stratosphere, it's 80,000 feet or something. So mm-hmm. how many tens of thousands of feet do you have to get high enough to for chemistry to start acting differently?
Oh, gotcha.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Great, Michael. Thanks a lot.
These are good questions. So I haven't honestly seen the specific studies about the oil and water mixture, but what I can speculate is that, you know, when you're in the space station, you're orbiting Earth. So you feel the Earth's gravity. You're still bound to it, but you feel weightless. You know, the astronauts are floating around, the material mixes differently. And what I'm guessing is happening is when you do these quote unquote zero gravity experiments is the materials are not falling under the force of gravity. So density acts differently, right? If you stack oil and water, they separate out because the density is different. In space, you know, water just balls up and floats around. And I'm guessing that, you know, there's surface tension on the oil and the water, and it must interact differently in this zero gravity environment. And that must be what they're seeing. I'd have to look and see,
wow,
you know, exactly what's happening chemically. But I think we're just finding that when you are not under the direct influence of gravity pulling you straight down and feeling the force of gravity like that, things must act differently.
Can you make salad dressing up there, you think?
Well, it sounds like maybe you can't. I'm not sure. It doesn't mix well. But
that's not going to bode well for a healthy diet up in space.
That's true. That's true. And to answer that second question, you know, the space station's a couple hundred miles above our head. And the trick is not so much height, right? If you just put yourself 100 miles above the Earth's surface, you're going to feel gravity and fall straight down. The trick is you have to be orbiting. That's what gives you the weightlessness. So as long as you don't feel the forces of gravity, if you feel weightless, that's where the chemistry seems like it's going to change and things are going to interact differently.
I'm glad you brought up the space station. I have questions about satellites that I'm sure are completely ignorant. But let's take a break. 800-348-2551. Dr. Valerie Rapson is our guest today. It's astronomy. We'll get back to the calls and your emails coming up. Clapton and Company there. Vox Pop here. Ray Graff with you at 800-348-2551. And Dr. Valerie Rapson joins us today for a talk about astronomy. Very quickly, before we get back to the calls.
Mm-hmm.
Looking at the space station flyover, you said it was a couple hundred miles up.
Yeah.
And it's going how fast?
Oh, gosh, I don't remember exactly. Fast.
All right, so here's my question. I also see some of these low Earth orbit satellites,
sure,
that go north-south,
sure,
right? Some of these spy satellites and what,
mm-hmm,
have you. Do they have to go faster because they're lower?
Yes. Yeah. So it depends on the height, right? When you're lower to the Earth, you feel a slightly stronger force of gravity because you're closer to it. So to balance that, you have to orbit at a faster speed so that you don't spiral down towards the Earth. And the farther away you go, the slower you can move in a circle and still be in a stable orbit around the planet.
All right. And when Starlinks go up or some, mm-hmm, of these other constellations that go up, you see,
right,
them, they're close together the first day and then they spread out over,
yeah,
a course of days sort of,
yeah,
along the same path. Presumably, and I might be wrong, but I assume they are gaining altitude day by day,
mm-hmm,
and they're spreading out.
Yes.
Do they get slower as they attain orbit? In other words, as the,
yeah,
I'm confused.
Yes.
We watch satellites and we'll say, believe me, we don't have much of a nightlife. And my wife and I will be out looking at the stars,
sure,
a lot. Some satellites seem to be going faster.
Yeah.
And we're not wrong. We're not nuts.
Yeah. No, you're not nuts at all. So it depends on the height. You'll see some, like the space station is relatively low compared to many of those satellites, so it'll move pretty quickly. Depending on, you know, exactly what level of Starlink we're talking about, some of them will be, you know, 500 miles up, some will be 300 miles up, and they do move at different speeds, and they're designed to make that change. They have, you know, small onboard thrusters where they can make small adjustments to put them at the right altitude and make them orbit at the right speed. Once you're up and moving at the right speed, if nothing bumps into you, if you don't feel any drag, then you don't have to change anything. So, I mean, it's one
of
the...
Do you no longer need the thrusters at that point?
Technically, no. I mean, there's still a very small amount of atmosphere that's always putting some drag on these satellites, which is why sometimes they come crashing down.
Yeah.
So, you know, in real life, yes. But theoretically, if there's no atmosphere, if there's nothing up there, then once you're moving at the right speed, you'll just stay moving like that forever.
Dr. Valerie Rapson is our guest. The number is 800-348-2551. Our old buddy Joe, who is a WAMC volunteer at the fund drive. Don't worry, okay. Joe, we'll be calling you and your wife very soon. He writes, RPI had some summer programs as recently as last year, although I checked their website and they haven't updated for 2026.
Ah, great. Yes. And I saw that there was a note about another caller who was maybe going to tell us about some at SUNY Albany. So I would just check all the local universities. I know many of them try and do these programs. It just kind of depends on funding and availability of the faculty and stuff.
But what happened to the caller? What, did he hang up?
I don't know. They were on the list.
Oh, really? I didn't see that one.
Yeah, there was one. It said, oh, programs at SUNY Albany, and then they disappeared. So I was hoping they were going to tell us about it. But
you're more attentive than the host. All right, let's go back to the phones. 800-348-2551. Bill is in North Adams. Bill, go ahead.
Hi. My question concerns something you mentioned before about the difference between looking at the universe on cosmological scale and trying to reconcile it with theorizing about the subatomic scale, you know, quantum mechanics. Mm-hmm. And this difficulty, I know, and I might be wrong about this, but maybe you can straighten me out. I've been reading that the mathematics that might be promising on the subatomic, on the quantum scale, might be like things like information theory or complexity theory that seems to involve consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been hearing some stuff about possibly consciousness being not as a basis, not being atoms, molecules, et cetera, energy, are not at the basis at the basic where what's there, but consciousness has to be somehow part of that, and that this applies also to the cosmological scale. The whole picture has to involve consciousness, and I'm wondering if you've heard anything about this. If this is just wacko fringe theorizing. Mm. Or whether this is really being taken seriously.
Well, have at it there, Val.
Well, I'll say that this is an excellent question, but you're asking the wrong astronomer, because Bob Berman wrote a whole book with some colleagues about this. More than one.
Yeah.
And he is really the expert on consciousness. I haven't really digested this very well. So honestly, I'm going to say call back next month. Bob should be here and ask him, because he will be able to answer this question way better than I can.
Frankly, I don't even know where he is right now. But yeah, he should be here next month. Yeah. This is all very interesting stuff. And I don't know, how would you...
Yeah, and I appreciate your...
Go ahead,
yeah,
Bill.
I appreciate your... Yeah, thanks a lot for the guidance there.
Yeah,
got it.
Yeah. I mean, it's not crazy, that's for sure. Like, we definitely need to explore all options, and where consciousness comes from is something we've been trying to figure out a long time.
How do you do science on that? This is what I don't understand.
Yeah, I'm not the doctor. I think you need to take the doctor and the astronomer and the biologist, you know, put them all together and really get their minds thinking about it, because, I mean, that's true. Okay. How do you test this? I don't know.
I think it's quite clear that there's much more going on in our universe than we can even imagine.
Oh, for sure.
Let's go to Chris in Scotia. Chris, you're on.
Hi, how are you? Thanks for taking my call. So I have a question about, you guys were talking about the heliopause previously, and I think I read, and I might be mistaken, but the temperature, the actual temperature of that perimeter, is it very hot there? Is that right?
Mm. So yes, the temperature is very hot, but you have to remember that we're not talking about like a physical heat that you can feel. We're talking about the speed of certain particles. So if you were to take an individual particle at the edge of the heliosphere, heliopause, whichever region, it's moving really fast, which translates to a high temperature. But if you could just place yourself out there and not worry about the vacuum of space and put your arm out into it, you wouldn't feel heat like you put your arm in an oven, because it's only a handful of particles that are actually hitting your body.
Would you feel pressure? In other words, if you were sensitive enough, would you feel pressure?
It depends on what the density of the particles are. You know, the short answer is yes. If you were sensitive enough, you would feel this pressure, because it's basically where the outward pressures from the sun are balancing the inward pressures from other things in the galaxy. So you would feel this pressure. And if you could sense, you know, how fast a particle is hitting you individually, then you would feel this higher temperature. But it's not like you would send a spacecraft through it and it would melt, because there's heat out there. That's not quite how it works. Does that make sense? Hopefully.
Absolutely. So if I could, I have one more question, which has to do with temperature. So if I'm smack dab in the middle of space, nothing's around anything in space because it's so vast, but you know, basically you're not near something.
Yeah.
Is the temperature of space absolute zero, or is it?
know,
can't
what is
be,
it?
Can it?
No, because if it was absolute zero, then the particles wouldn't be moving and we couldn't have the universe that we have today. The temperature is 2.7 Kelvin, which is about -450 degrees Fahrenheit.
It's pretty cold.
Yeah, it's really cold. It's
pretty
almost
cold.
Absolute zero, but not quite there.
Okay. Thank you.
Chris,
you're welcome.
Thanks a lot for the call. The number here is 800-348-2551. Email is voxpop@wamc.org. I really find it fascinating, and I really didn't think too much about the heliopause until Voyager was
sure.
beyond it.
Yeah, yeah.
The business of pressure coming from other stars.
Uh-huh.
Particles or
yeah.
what have you. Photons, presumably?
Yeah, anything. It could be high-energy individual particles, photons, all sorts of stuff.
They have to be very far apart at that distance, right, in the middle of space. How far apart are these particles?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know that we can really measure it. Voyager's giving us some clues as to, like, how many particles that hit. But, you know, we're talking about 1960s technology, technically. It launched in the 70s, but the technology's earlier than that. So we don't have great measurements on exactly how much is out there. So we're still trying to figure that piece out.
Is there more activity in the depths of space than we can even imagine?
Yes.
When there's apparently nothing.
I took an entire semester-long class about the material that's in between galaxies. Like, not even in between stars. Like, in a galaxy, you know there's tons of gas and dust and stuff. Like, intergalactic medium.
How
where
do you
there's,
know it's
like,
there?
Literally nothing there. I took a whole semester class on that material. So... yeah, it's a very small amount of stuff, but if you want to do like the true deep science, you really have to account for it.
Amazing. But again, how do you quantify it given what we have and how far away the galaxies are?
Right.
I mean, how do you know how much stuff is there?
You make the best observations you can. For that you rely on like galaxies that are colliding where the material heats up and you can actually see the intergalactic medium a bit more, and then you just have to model it out, right? If we see this amount of material in galaxies that are closer together, stretch that out and expand it through the whole universe, there must be material that we can't really see well in between the galaxies elsewhere.
You know, back I think at the turn of the 20th century, it was very common for people to talk about the ether,
mm-hmm.
you know,
and
that was sort of then shunned
right.
as we learned about space.
Right.
But really, there is an ether. There are particles
sure.
out there all over the
yeah.
place.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Emptiness is not a thing.
No, it's really not.
Dr. Valerie Rapson is our guest today. It's astronomy. 800-348-2551 is the number. The email is voxpop@wamc.org. Should we go to another Valerie? Could we take two Valeries
let's
in one
do
show?
It.
All right, let's try it. Niska Yuna, Valerie, you're on.
Hi, thank you. Yes, yesterday you had a show, Ray, about UFOs. It was very interesting, as well as today's show is very interesting. And I just wondered if Valerie had any thoughts or opinions or what's her take on UFOs
okay, so
and what you think about?
This is good that we're doing this now, Valerie, because sometimes when we do this early in the astronomy shows, it takes over the whole show. But we're getting toward the end of this. You still have time to squeeze in at 800-348-2551.
Mm-hmm.
We've talked about it a lot,
sure.
Valerie. I mean, what is a real, you know, Dr. Kevin Knuth is as real a scientist as you
mm-hmm.
can get, and he's doing science on this. What do you think?
Yeah, so I've said on this show before, and I'll say it again, I'm very pro-alien in a sense that I feel like there's got to be life out there somewhere. I'm hesitant to say that it has visited the Earth. I'm positive that 3i Atlas is not an interstellar spacecraft. So I'm excited for the possibility, and I'm really excited that people like Kevin are doing these studies with a scientific mindset, because we do need to look into this, these weird videos and things that are coming out. Like, we should explore this from a scientific standpoint without the, you know, assumption that we are looking at an alien spacecraft. Let's look at this all scientifically and see if we can attribute this to something more reasonable. And if not, that still leaves it open for the idea that it might be alien.
And, you know, Valerie, Bob Berman, who is not here today, he's AWOL. I have no idea where he is. He's very much a skeptic. And he was a pilot for a long time.
Yeah.
And he's fond of saying, you know, I've flown hundreds of hours,
sure.
never seen anything that I couldn't explain.
Yeah.
So I just don't know.
Yeah. And I mean, I wish I could sit here and say that I saw an alien spacecraft before. I've never seen anything that I couldn't explain in the sky. But I'm not 100%.
You've never seen anything. To me, I think they're two separate things.
Mm-hmm.
Seeing something like a UFO or something you can't explain, which
sure.
is a UFO, doesn't mean necessarily aliens.
Right.
But you've never seen anything you can't explain in the sky.
I've never seen something that wasn't obviously a star and a planet or something terrestrial, like an airplane or a drone. You can usually tell just by, you know, whether or not it has lights and its motion and stuff. I've never seen anything where I watched it in the sky and I went, huh, that doesn't seem like an airplane or something I've seen before. So that keeps me hesitant, but I'm optimistic and I'm very excited to see what people come up with.
Valerie and Niskayuna, what do you think?
I mean, I think it's great. I'm fully in as a believer. I have an older son who sends me all kinds of videos and books and things like that.
Nice.
But I'm also wondering, do you think, Valerie, there's a concerted effort on the part of governments over time to sort of squelch this information from getting out there publicly or deny or... And if so, why would they do that?
Yeah.
Why would they do that?
I don't know. I think if somebody was to come out with definitive proof that there's aliens, I think a lot of people would go crazy. So I think it'd be hard to handle. But what I can say is that, you know, our government in the last couple of years under both recent administrations have put a decent amount of funding towards studying these UAPs and stuff like that. So we are now actually putting time and effort and money into trying to figure it out. And I think it would be really hard for an entire government to hide the fact that aliens exist. There's just too many people. Somebody would blab to somebody and the
Maybe.
Word would get out.
Valerie, both of the Valeries, I do recommend that you guys watch Age of Disclosure.
Oh, yes.
And I think it's on Amazon right now. It's fairly new. It'll open your eyes, Valerie and Niskayuna.
And what would definitive proof be? Because I feel like there has been pretty significant proof, you know, people reporting, actually seeing aliens, seeing, you know, beings. So I don't know. At this point, I don't know how people can fully discount that.
Yeah. Valerie, I would do a show on this every day if I could, but they would fire me immediately. So thank you for the call. This email, very quickly, Val, from Rachel, Dark Energy.
Yeah.
Hawking explained dark energy as function of gravitational waves opposites, question mark?
Oh, so yeah, there's kind of this theory that black holes and radiation from black holes is playing a role in dark energy. I don't remember all of the details of it, but it's possible that what we are perceiving as dark energy has something to do with the radiation that comes from, in particular, the supermassive black holes that is contributing over long periods of time to this push we see in the universe. But it hasn't fully been proven yet. But it's one more speculation that we're trying to investigate.
What? Okay, and maybe we don't know the answer. What form of radiation is coming from black holes? I thought black holes, everything goes in, nothing goes out.
Right.
Explain.
Well, black holes are very complicated. We're not talking about the black hole spitting anything out. Nothing is actually coming out from inside of the event horizon. But when material falls in, sometimes it splits into matter and antimatter, and some parts will go in, some parts will go out. And Hawking has ideas of black holes evaporating. So around the edges, you know, the material will fall in, and then the strength of gravity somehow changes. And essentially, you get this evaporation and disappearance of the black holes, which is kind of like a radiation.
Where does it go?
I don't know for sure. It's a little bit beyond my, you know, knowledge area here. But that's what we're trying to figure out is, are black holes perpetual, or are they making changes to our universe and contributing some sort of energy to the vacuum energy of space? It's possible. And we haven't put all the pieces together.
That black holes, now, correct me if I'm wrong, but it's thought that black holes are at the center of every galaxy, right?
Yes, for the most part,
sort of the engine of a galaxy. Mm-hmm. Galaxies turn. Do they all turn?
Yes, they all spin.
Are they all spinning and getting closer to the event horizon?
Well, so the galaxies themselves are all rotating.
They're rotating around.
They're rotating around the black hole, and the black hole actually spins in most cases, too.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, there's some weird properties of black holes like that. But the material is not all in falling. It's not like a drain where eventually all the material is just going to fall into the black hole and be done. You have to be nudged in that direction. You have to be pushed in towards the black hole to actually fall in, because just like the satellites orbiting the Earth, they're in a stable orbit around the Earth. And unless something creates a drag, they're not going to fall in. And the same is true of material in a galaxy. Unless there's some drag that forces it towards the black hole, we will orbit our galaxy forever. Stars will orbit the black hole forever and be just fine.
But, and we only have 20 seconds, so now we're into another part of it. Andromeda and our galaxy are going to collide at some point,
maybe,
right?
There's new research that says maybe not, but go on.
But if two galaxies collide,
yes,
presumably they both have, oh, the show's over. Presumably they have black holes in the middle.
Yes.
What happens?
They could combine, and there's actually a new discovery where one was kicked out when it combined. We'll talk about it next time.
All right. Thank you, Valerie Rapson. You're fantastic.
Welcome.
Support comes from Albany Wine and Dine for the Arts, presenting the Albany Chefs Food and Wine Festival, a three-day festival featuring chefs, restaurants, and mixologists to benefit Albany arts organizations. AlbanyWineFest.com/2026. At the Hyde Collection in Glens Falls, featuring Sharon Corr, 1606 to the 60s, a new exhibition of photographs that mimic works of art by Dutch and American masters, on view now through February 1st, hydecollection.org. Thanks again to Dr. Valerie Rapson for being here. Thanks to Bob Berman, too. He may be on another planet and just not able to check in today. Maybe the phone line connection wasn't as good. Thanks to Zach Malloy, our engineer. Thank you for listening. Thanks for the calls. Thanks for the emails. Thanks to Susie Chekai, one of the greats of all time, screened the calls today. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow at 2 p.m., oh gosh, it's Food Friday. Time for some chat about cheese. We welcome Mary Rizzo, Shalina Bridgham, and John Fisher. It'll be wine and cheese. We'll see you tomorrow at 2.